Okay. So we're talking about the byte, and again, we write it with the least significant bit, bit 0, on the right, and the most significant bit, bit 7, on the left. The important thing here is that when we calculate a number from this byte, then we look, bit 0 is called the least significant bit because that is the lowest number that we use to represent a 1. So, for example, if bit 0 is on, then that's a 1. If bit 7 is on, then that's 2 to the... That's probably 128. Yeah, 128. So bit 7 is the most significant because it counts the most toward the number total, and bit 0 is the least significant because it counts the least toward the number total. I think that's a pretty good way of thinking about it. So now I'm moving on to slide 10. So this is kind of an analysis of the byte, so that we know how they get these weird numbers. Yeah, I really have to go on here because I don't know if I'm going to make it through all the lectures in time, or all the slides in time, so I'm just going to continue. Sorry about that. So with slide 10, here we're talking about the byte again, and this is kind of a derivation of how we can calculate how many possible numbers we can store inside a byte. And this is really important in computer literature. You'll see that in a byte, you can store between the numbers 0 and 256, or 0 and 255, with a total of 256 numbers that can be possibly represented. So first of all, if we represent all of the bits with a 0 inside a byte, if every single one of the bits is a 0, then we'll get a decimal number 0 using that scheme that we planned out earlier, because it's 0 times anything is a 0. So 0 times 2 to the 7th is a 0, and 0 times 2 to the 0th is a 0. So if we sum all those together, then that equals a 0. On the other hand, we know that if we multiply a value by 1 instead of 0, that's a larger number than 0. So we can replace every number with a 1 inside that byte, every bit with a 1, and that comes out to be 255. And you can even plug that into a calculator if you're really motivated and come up with 255. So the point is, in slide 11, that the smallest number we can store in a byte is a 0, and the largest numbers are 255. So the numbers 1 through 255, that there are 255 numbers there. And then because we also have that 0, that makes a total of 256 numbers that can be stored in the byte. And that's pretty neat. So a really fun exercise, if you really want to understand all of this stuff, is to try to derive this, the maximum and the smallest numbers, for different amounts of bits. So, for instance, on slide 11, I guess it isn't on slide 11, but on slide 11, you can derive these numbers for 16-bit values, and you can derive these numbers for 32-bit values. And later on in these slides, you'll actually see what the numbers are for these values. But it would help a lot if you were able to figure these out by yourself, if you really want to understand what's going on at the very most fundamental level of the computer, which is the bit. So on slide 12, in C, we can represent things with different data types. Now, when we were talking about ASCII earlier, we decided that there were 256 different ASCII codes. And there were 256 different numbers that represented 256 different letters, or different characters. And in C or C++, a byte of data, which is 8 bits long, is known as a char, or a character. Some people also say char. So it's either a char or a char, from what I've heard. And that's a character. And the important thing to remember, though, is although in C, a character is a lot of times used as an ASCII character, it's only a number. It's only a number of bits that are flipped on or off. And in the chat room, Slavic is right, and we're going to get to that in the next slide. So in slide 13, so the question becomes, so if we think about all the possible numbers, integers, negative numbers, positive numbers, floating point numbers, the scheme that we've discussed so far is only valid for positive numbers. And it's only valid for integers, too. So the question becomes, how do we store negative numbers in the computer? And one of the most popular ways to store these, and the ways that, and this is the way that we are probably going to see in C and C++ compilers, is that negative numbers are stored by having bit 7 of the byte, the most significant bit, be hold a value of 1 if the number is negative, or hold a value of 0 if it's positive. So if bit 7 is 1, then the whole number is negative. But the thing is that we're taking up that bit to tell if the rest of the number is positive or negative. So that decreases the maximum number of digits, or the maximum number of numbers that we can represent with 8 bits. So since we took away that 7th bit, then we're down to a different range from negative 127 to positive 127. And again, it would be really cool if you can calculate this by yourself using bits. And a character is not a short unsigned int. We'll get to short ints later, but a character is 8 bits and a short int is 16 bits. There is only a character primitive. In the Windows API, however, they do define a byte all in capital letters, to be a character, which is 8 bits. So it's important to realize that if your number is signed, if it can have a negative or a positive symbol in front of it, then the resolution of your number, the maximum number of numbers that this can represent, is cut in half, basically. And another important thing to note is that 0 can be represented two ways using this scheme. 0 can either be represented as a positive 0 or as a negative 0. And while this isn't really problematic, it does cause us to lose another number that we could have represented earlier. So because of that 0 in there, we can only represent 255 possible numbers instead of 256. Yes, a lot of people will create a byte type def as a character or unsigned character. And in fact, I'd probably prefer it being an unsigned character. And again, a byte is 8 bits, and that's the formal name for it. And a character is also 8 bits. So people often use a type def because the type def, well, what if the definition of a character changes from 8 bits to something else? Then it's a lot more difficult to change every single instance of a character inside your code. But if you use a type def and you're type defing a byte instead of char, and that definition for a character changes, then you can change it everywhere in your code at once. Or better yet, maybe the definition of a character won't change, but what if you suddenly decide that you don't want to use any more characters and you want to use all integers? It's a lot easier to change one line than it is to change every line in your code. And that's sort of the rationale behind the type def, making it a byte. So now we're on slide 14. So the question is, what in the world is it, what does it mean by a 32-bit processor? So the processor on your system, there are lots of different forms of memory, and in general, the farther away the memory is from the processor, the slower it is to access it. So we have the hard drive, which is really far away, and we have the RAM, which is on the same motherboard, and we actually have some memory on slide 15 that's really close to the processor. In fact, it's right next to the processor. And some of this memory is called registers. And there's actually an optimal value for each microprocessor of bits that it can handle at once. For example, if a microprocessor wants to add two numbers together, it can't add like 128-bit numbers together unless the microprocessor is designed for it. So with a 32-bit processor, the maximum length of two numbers that it can add together is 32 bits. So it can add one 32-bit number to one 32-bit number. And that happens to be, at the bottom of the slide, the data type integer. I'm confusing you. You actually don't have to understand this, but what is important to understand is that if you have a 32-bit processor, then an integer data type in C will be 32 bits. If you have a 16-bit processor, an integer data type will be 16 bits. If you have a 64-bit processor, the int's going to change. So if you design your program right now with ints, then they'll probably change to 64 bits when everyone gets a 64-bit processor. And this can be damaging to your program. So a lot of people define things like a D word, a double word. A double word's 32 bits. So they're going to do a typedef D word, and that'll be 32 bits. So then they can change that if they want to, or leave it like it was. And a D word would be an unsigned short, or an unsigned long, I'm sorry. That would be 32 bits. And that's all that explained on slide 16. So we have lots of different variable types in C. And we're asked, how many registers are there on the Intel 32-bit processor? There are lots of registers. There are many more than four. In fact, they're actually EAX, EBX, ECX, and EDX for general purposes. Then we have things like the instruction pointer and the stack pointer. We have, like as Slavik said, four segment registers. There are even extensions to the processor, like a floating point coprocessor or something, and you can actually access all of these registers. And again, registers are just like variables. They're just places to hold values. The only difference is they're right next to the microprocessor. So, back to slide 16. So we have different variable types in C and C++. And a character variable type will be 8 bits, just like we said before. And then we also have a short int, a long int, and then just an int. And a short int can be abbreviated to, is 16 bits, and it can represent 65,537 possible values, and half of that if you use a signed notation, if it can be positive or negative, remember. So this is the sort of the maximum number of combinations there are of bits. And it's only half of that if you use signed again. And so if you want to use any of these in your code, feel free. And I'm sure the question right now is, why don't we just always use a 32-bit number? Why would we even bother with characters and 16-bit numbers? Well, nowadays a lot of people just do use 32-bit numbers. And in fact, it's a little faster if you use a 32-bit number, because if you have a 32-bit processor, then it's the fastest to operate with 32-bit numbers. And some instances where you'd use an 8-bit number, though, are if you want to store text. Text can be represented as 8 bits. Or if you wanted to optimize things by sending out network packets, for instance, then things need to be really small. So you might want to use characters or 8-bit values if numbers can only have 256 states. Then it would be a waste of memory to use more than that. So on slide 17, how do we declare a variable? So when we declare a variable, then we allocate some memory for the variable. So the computer looks in your RAM and it finds some memory that isn't being used by another program, and then it's going to set aside that memory for your program, and you can place values into it. So if I write char myvar and then with a semicolon, then right there I'm allocating 8 bits of memory which I can read and write to. and we're asked if people really use short ends. And yes, they can, although it isn't very common. Yeah, you could do it to conserve memory. Also, we can initialize values. So if we write char my var equals 5, then this declares the variable my var, and it initializes it to the value 5. So if we move to slide 18, and someone said that short ints still get padded, and by padding he means that they add that it's actually a 32-bit number, but they add zeros to it. Sometimes that's the case, but that's only the case if the compiler is compiling for optimizations, because that'll make it faster if it's a 32-bit value for the compiler or for the microprocessor to process. And that is correct, that 64-bit processors would probably handle 64-bit variables best. And that's why they have the integer type to make that optimization. So in slide 18, we're talking about variables. And variables can either be local or global. And this is scoping. It is a very important concept. If a variable is global, then the variable is created when the program starts, and it's destroyed when the program ends. If a variable is local, then the variable memory is allocated when you declare the variable, which can be anywhere in your program, and it's deallocated, it's destroyed, whenever it reaches a closing brace. So if you declare a variable in your main function, then when you leave the main function, it's going to destroy that variable. So the question again is, why don't we just use everything, why don't we just make everything a global variable? Well, then numbers get very, very hard to track. And in fact, it's very much preferred if you can make every single number, or every single variable, a local variable. Although in some cases, global variables are necessary. But in C++, we actually have things called namespaces, and we have things called classes. And this pretty much eliminates the global variable problem. So that is a good thing, because, I mean, it's really easy to mess up things with global variables. And I'm sure you'll see this as you start programming. So just try to keep your variables local, although in some cases it is necessary to make global variables. Slide 19. We've been talking about signed variables and unsigned variables. If we make one unsigned, just as we said before, then it can store a value, for example, with a character, it can store a value from 0 to 255. And with a signed variable, then we can store a number in the entire range, not in the entire range, but from half that to positive half that, just like we've been saying. So that's an example of how you declare two variables of the unsigned and signed type. So in slide 20, what's an operator? An operator is a symbol that performs a certain function. So, for example, we have the equals operator, the assignment operator. And we can set a variable equal to a value. So in our examples at the bottom of slide 20, very simple. We're saying that the variable numLives, which could be a character, it could be an integer, it equals 5 minus the content of another variable called starting level. And the variable starting level can be anything, too. So numLives will be set equal to the result of that. Now here's a little tricky thing. This is kind of tricky. Here we're saying numLives equals numLives plus 1. So the question is, you know, we're using numLives on both sides, so it doesn't really compute. But what happens is, we start on the right side of the equal sign, and we say numLives, the current value of numLives, and then we add 1 to it. And then we store that result into the variable numLives. So this is like saying we take the old value of numLives, we add 1 to it, then we store this back into numLives, making a new value. So that's something important to remember. On slide 21, there are 5 basic mathematical operators: addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and the modulus. And something that is really confusing to new people at the bottom of that slide is that if we're working with integer values, then it truncates decimals. So if we do a 5 divided by 2, then that's going to be 2.5 normally. But if we're working with an integer value, then that truncates it to just 2. Similarly, if we take 3 times 1.5, which would normally be 4.5, we just chop off the decimal, and we get a 4. And you have to remember that, because that'll give you really strange results in the future if you don't remember that you're storing it into an integer. It just can't hold a float value. And so now we have a question whether we would use a signed character. And the answer is, you can use anything that suits your application. It's there. People do use it, because people tend to write character more than they do unsigned character. So people do use it, but I think that in any application, you'll know what's best to use. So it's there if you want to use it. People might use it, they might not, but the important thing is to use it in the for your particular application. So I'm moving on to slide number 22, and here we're talking about the modulus operator. And the modulus operator is a little confusing to start out with as well. But if we perform a division, if we, for example, do 1 divided by 2, then we're going to come out with a whole number of zero, and our fraction will be 1/2. So we're taking this number and we're converting it to from a purely fractional form to a whole number plus a fraction, just like you've done in school. So in this case, the 1 in the 1/2 will be the result of the modulus. It's the remainder. Similarly, if we do 5 divided by 3, then that's equal to 1 plus 2/3. So our remainder will be 0. And then for the last one, our remainder is 0, simply because there isn't a fractional part. And someone asks whether the truncation or the chopping doesn't happen at the calculation, but at the final assignment. And the answer to that is, it depends. This is kind of a tricky issue, but I haven't actually put, there are actually things called, there's an order of operations for the mathematical operators, and the order of operations is actually the same as the order of operations for real math that you probably learned in school. And whether it'll chop things off or not is determined by what types all of the variables are. So if one of your values is a fraction, for instance, and one of them is an integer in an expression, then it'll convert the integer to a fraction just for that calculation, and then it's going to do the truncation. But if you have lots of different variables in a complicated expression, then you can actually force it to chop things at certain points through a technique called casting variables. And that's really important too, but I didn't include it in these slides, maybe for Thursday. But in general, you'll have to wait until the next lecture to see about casting. But for the 3 times 1.5, technically we should have a cast there that's casting it to a long, because you'll get a compiler error saying that we're trying to store a fractional, a decimal value, into a long, and that's impossible. So we'll get it's a compiler warning. And we'll have to use something called a cast there to get it back, or to do it properly. When we use a cast, we're just telling the compiler, like, I know that that's going to be truncated, and that's what I want to happen. But we'll get into those next lecture. So now I'm moving on to slide number 23, and we're looking at prefix and postfix. We're more specifically looking at shortcuts. These are really popular shortcuts too. If I do numLives plus equals 1, then that's the same thing as numLives equals numLives plus 1. And for the current health, the minus and the equals should be right next to each other. That's equal to current health equals current health minus 50. And these are really really popular, really fun to use, little shorthands. There are some problems you can get into with using them, but not very many. And another important shorthand is the prefix-postfix operator. People always get confused. You know, what if I have put the plus plus in front of it or after it? What's the difference? So if I have a long, complicated expression for a certain variable, and it has lots of different calculations and everything that's done in a single line, and I put a plus plus in front of the variable, then it's going to increment that variable before the rest of the statement is evaluated. So if I do plus plus numLives, then if numLives equals 0 before the expression, then numLives will equal 1 when we start evaluating the expression. However, if I have numLives plus plus in a long, complicated expression, and I initially set numLives equal to 0, when I evaluate that expression, numLives will still equal 0. It'll only be evaluated. It will only increment numLives once the expression is done. So that's a really important distinction, and it'll take a little playing around. But if you've ever seen a for loop before, we have an i++ at the rightmost element of that for loop. And the i++ means let's increment I by 1 every time through the loop. Okay, slide 24. This is really important because this is something that you can really just jump onto and use immediately. And this is how do we make the if statement a little more useful. Before, we've just been saying if key down vk underscore up, for instance. But now we can say, like, what if a variable is greater than 640? You know, what if it goes past the rightmost boundary of the screen? Then let's do something important. Let's do something about that, because it can't go past the rightmost part of the screen. Or, you know, what if we're doing a guessing game and the user actually guesses what our number is? So it's if the guess is equal to the number, then we're going to print you win. And something that's really important is we looked at the assignment operator before, and that's just a single equal sign. But the comparison operator is a double equal sign. You have to be very, very careful that you don't put a single equal sign there, because when you're comparing two values, you always need to use a double equal sign. That gets a lot of people in trouble too, because an assignment, if you say if guess single equals 0, that returns a true or a false 2 to the if statement. So the if statement's going to say, hey, I got a true or false, so this is valid input. But it isn't valid input because it's not what you meant it to do. So that comparison there evaluates to a true or a false, and your if statement's expecting a true or a false, and so it acts on that value, and if it's true, it'll execute the code inside the braces, just like before. So slide 25, what can you do now? So now you can actually make a simple game with variables. So let's say we use that setPixel routine that we've been working with before, and instead of putting static values in for where we're going to put our pixel on the screen, we put in some variables, and variables can change with time. So if the user presses up, maybe we can increment one of those variables, and we can have the ball move to the right or move down on the screen. And that's really important for making games, because we need things to move around the screen. So something that would be really simple to start with, and something that might be in the homework next time, is, you know, try to make a ball bounce off the sides of the screen. And that should be something you can do with just if statements and just pixels. And that'll be kind of a really neat screensaver to start out with too. One of the things that I grew up doing was making screensavers in QBasic. And you can make little cones that go bounce around the screen. You can really do some neat things with screensavers. And the best thing is, if you don't clear the screen every time, you can actually make some really cool effects because your pixels will leave a trail on the screen. So even with the simple knowledge base you have right now, with if statements, that while loop that we had in the framework, and with variables, you can make a ball bounce around the screen, and you can even start to put in some paddles, maybe, to do a Pong game. Some really exciting stuff. So, with slide 26, I'm just going to start with this. I don't know how far I'll get, but I'm going to try to use the knowledge we've gained about the sort of the theory knowledge about how a byte works, how bits work, to explain how exactly a pixel is stored on the screen. So, when we talk about a bit depth of a certain resolution, if we say, like, our display has 32 bits, or it has 16 bits, or it's a 24-bit display currently, well, 24-bit color has three 8-bit channels, one for red, one from green, and one from blue. And remember, any color can be made with a combination of red, green, and blue. This is sort of the opposite of what you learned in paint class when you were using paints. But with light rays, the three elements that make up any color are red, green, and blue. And so in the computer monitor, then we either have with an LED monitor, or I'm sorry, an LCD display, then there are actually little dots that are red, green, and blue for every pixel. And for a CRT monitor, we have three different electron guns, one that's red, one that's green, and one that's blue. And with a combination of those three colors, then we can make any color. So for 24-bit color, we have three different channels, one for red, green, and blue, and each is 8 bits. So 8 times 3 is 24 bits, and that's how we come up with 24-bit color. It takes 24 bits to represent one color. Now, 32-bit color is usually the same as 24-bit color. It has 8 bits per channel, but it usually has one byte of padding added on. And if we go to slide 27, we can see that there's red, green, and blue, and then there's a byte of padding. And again, padding is just zeros, usually. It doesn't matter. All that it's there for is to make operations a little faster on your microprocessor. So if you have a 32-bit processor, then the padding there is going to make your value, your number, 32 bits. So that's going to be operated on more efficiently in your processor than a 24-bit number, which is really hard for a processor to work with. So let's say we want pure red. So using this model for how we pack colors onto the screen, right? We're going to have all ones in the red section, and then all zeros everywhere else. So we can, using that scheme we learned earlier, we're going to multiply that out and get a number. And the really neat thing is, and we got some number, it looks like it's 16,711,680. The really neat thing is, if you pass this really weird number into that set pixel routine, it's going to print pure red. So all that RGB32 thing that you type in does, all that that does is make a number up out of those values you pass in. So now you know, if you want a pure green, you can calculate what the number is going to be. And that would be a really cool thing to do to understand how bits work too. Would be to, you know, figure out some things, what some numbers would be, and test it in your code. Because it's really important that you understand how the bit works. So in slide 28, you often hear that 32-bit color, with that you can represent 1.6 million colors. And here's the little derivation. You can do that now. We have three channels of 256 possible colors each. So if we multiply 256 by 256 by 256, then we get 1.6 million colors. And that's that value that you hear. That's the maximum number of colors you can represent on the screen, because you have three channels that can each represent 256 different colors. So, why is it faster for the CPU to use more bits? Because CPUs, a 32-bit processor, is designed, to handle 32 bits at a time, and it's designed to handle that in the most efficient manner. So a processor can actually do operations on two 32-bit numbers faster than it can do an operation on, say, two 24-bit numbers, which are really hard for it to work with. So that's why we want things in blocks of 32 bits. When we move to 64-bit processors, then we'll want things in blocks of 64 bits. So let's use our knowledge so far and try to write a little program that'll take three input values, a percentage of red, green, and blue instead of 0 through 255, and then display this color pixel on the screen. So in slide 29, first we're going to declare our four variables, the red, green, blue, and final color. And this is something I might add to the framework, just a little get integer so that we can get some user input. So for the red, green, and blue colors. And so after we get the input and we store it in red, green, and blue, we're going to look at the next step. First of all, we need to scale the numbers so that they're between 0 and 255 instead of 0 and 100, because in a percentage, it's from 0 to 100. The percent thing is just easier for people to think about than a number between 0 and 255. It takes a while for you to think of what 3/4 intensity would be. So the how we scale these are we multiply a number from 0 to 100 by 2.55. And we think about it, if we think about it, 0 times 2.55 is 0, which is what we want, and 100% times 2.55, sorry, not 100%, but 100 times 2.55 is 255, which is the exact value that we want. And so we do those three multiplications, and this is casting. It's saying the result of this value is going to be a fraction, but I'm going to cast it, and I'm saying I know it's going to be a fraction, so I just want you to truncate that value for me and store it as an unsigned long, because we need it in the value. We need it as an unsigned long because we can't do fractions when we're storing it inside our 32-bit value. So really fast, in slide 30, we're going to look at some bit shifting. And normally this isn't introduced until later on, but this is kind of a cool thing. And it really applies when we're talking about putting numbers together into a longer number, like we might want to do when we're putting a pixel on the screen. So when we're performing bit shifting, then here's something really neat to notice. In base 10, let's say we have a string like 123, and we shift all of the digits down to the left one, and we get 1,230. Well, that's a multiply by 10, isn't it? And if we shift 123 down two digits and add zeros onto the right, then we get 13,200. And that's the same as if we multiplied by 100. So in general, if we multiply by 10 to the nth power, then we can shift the digits to the left n times, and that's the resulting number. So similarly, in base 2, a left shift is a multiplication by 2 to the n this time. So if we want to multiply by 2, we shift all the bits to the left by one position. If we want to multiply by 4, we shift the bits left two positions. And similarly, a right shift is a division by 2 to the n. So remember, a left shift is a multiplication, a right shift is a division. And this whole multiplication-division thing only works if the variable is stored as an unsigned integer. It doesn't work on fractional values because those are stored using a different method. So in slide 31, we can also think of bit shifting not as multiplying and dividing, but as sliding the bits along the spectrum there. So in slide 32, we might have to swap back between slide 32 and slide 27. But you can see here that if we take our red value and we shift it left 16 bits, remember that the red value is an 8-bit value, although it's stored as an unsigned long. We know there are only 8 bits in red. So if we shift those 8 bits left 16 places, then they're going to line up exactly with the red position in that that diagram I had of what a 32-bit color looks like. So if we shift the red to the left for 16-bit positions, they're going to exactly line up with the red place, right? And we know for a fact, we don't know for a fact, but because we didn't do any error checking, but if we only had a byte stored in the variable red, then if we add that on to a green byte that shifted left 8 positions right into that green notch, and we add that to a blue that's just sitting there on the rightmost byte, then we've just packed an entire pixel color into a 32-bit value. And remember, here it doesn't matter what the padding is stored in, so we don't even worry about the padding here. And so, finally, when we set our pixel on the screen, if we just set it to final color, that variable there, then it's going to print that final color on the screen. And that's just a really amazing thing. In fact, if we look at the bottom of this slide here, then that's exactly what happens in that RGB32 macro that you were using in the set pixel routine. It's the exact same formula. And that's just a derivation of how that color thing is worked out. It's kind of confusing. We went over a lot of stuff today. It's really confusing, in fact. But if you look at this and if you understand how bits work, then this will go wonders in trying to figure out how to pack different bit depths, or even how to make your own packing mechanisms for color. And so finally, if we look at slide 33, the important thing from this is, if you have problems compiling the framework, send me an email, please, at itcc_teachers@pclx.com. Homework 2 will not be available until Wednesday. And up till then, I'm going to do my best to resolve some more problems with the framework, particularly looking at Visual Studio 6.0 and looking at Visual Studio 2005, because it looks like most of our errors are occurring with those two compilers. And if you have one of those compilers, then please hang on for a while when I get this worked out. The framework's actually a lot of code, and unfortunately, since we're doing this for free, I don't have the resources to look at every single compiler and try to get it working. So I'm going to post on the forums, on the message board, sort of a post asking for people, if they got it to work with Visual Studio 6 or Visual Studio 2005, to please post the steps that you took to get the framework to compile. So again, the homework will be sent out Wednesday. We will have a Thursday lecture now. I think that we're going to try to get Andrew to lecture for a while, if he's on. I don't see him on today for some reason. He said he'd be here. But I think that's about it for this lecture. So thank you very much for coming, and we'll get back to you about your homework that you submitted so far, and maybe give you some comments on that. We really appreciate your coming here, and I'm really glad that we got the shoutcast out, so I'd like to give a shout out to Slavic for hosting this. Thank you very much.